When I was a little girl, my grandmother got a chance to vote for the first time. She had to write her name before she could vote. And I remember teaching her how to write her name. And I remember she got all dressed up and she got her best Sunday dress and her purse and she walked to vote. And I'm gonna put on my best Sunday dress and I'm gonna go voting on Tuesday for my grandmother, because I'm gonna follow through with that dream. And that's why I'm here today. You know, I didn't have any money. I lost my job, but I had some time. And I've never done this before, but I volunteered my time to go and call people and tell them about absentee voting and tell them about early voting. And we've got real people problems, you know? And that's why I'm here.
That was a citizen of Florida in 2008 talking about participating in an activity that is a cornerstone in American democracy, voting. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective production by producers in Pacifica Network. We are your hosts for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg
and Stephanie Schubert. In today's edition, the story of the struggle between American voting rights and voter suppression.
I looked to a battleground state where I figured I'd make a difference, and I went to North Carolina. I was there for 2 weeks, and I was at one of the poll watching sites with, I call her Sister Gloria, African American. We were talking to people, you know, to see, you know, if they needed help or guidance on voting, and these white folks told her to go back to the plantation. And I was just shocked, horrified. How could this be in the United States of America that any person would feel that they could say that? And Sister Gloria said, you know, I've heard way worse than that, Ren. We had other people in line who called us baby killers, who said that we had, you know, children in our basements and that we were molesting them. They didn't have any bones about yelling and screaming in the lines when people are trying to vote.
While we've seen great expansions in the American electorate, it's been greeted by voter suppression.
Robert Hoffman, Deputy Director of the Democracy Division of the American Civil Liberties Union.
We are seeing a response from state legislatures to make it more difficult for voters to come back in future elections. In a 2008 election where we saw an incredible increase in turnout for Black voters, Hispanic voters, and for Asian American voters, along with youth voters, we saw this great expansion in the electorate greeted with voter suppression at state legislatures, introduced throughout the country to increase voter ID requirements and make it more difficult for individuals to register and cast a ballot. Now we're seeing something similar. Just like in 2008, in the 2020 election, the electorate was incredibly engaged and we saw a huge increase in turnout among parts of the electorate that don't traditionally turn out and vote. We had a 7% increase in turnout with nearly 160 million voters. And now we're seeing over 350 bills introduced in 47 states that are going to restrict access to the ballot. And you can go back in American history, you know, in Mississippi, you know, following the 15th Amendment in 1870, we saw registration for Black male voters at 90%, but that was greeted with voter suppression efforts from state legislatures to make it more difficult.
Is this about race?
It's impossible to disentangle the two. Race is always a part of American policy. And we do know that this wave of legislation coming across state legislatures is going to have a disproportionate impact on voters of color.
On Thursday, March 25th, Republican legislators in the state of Georgia passed a sweeping law restricting voter access in the state, introducing more rigid voter identification requirements for absentee balloting, limiting drop boxes, and expanding the legislature's power over elections. Georgia led initiatives to overhaul state election systems since the turmoil of last year's presidential contest. Heather Gray at WRFG Community Radio sat down with Ray McClendon, chairman of political action of the NAACP in Atlanta.
We're talking about what's happening with voting issues here in Georgia. Give us an update. The greatest threat that we have to voting rights is being perpetrated across the United States with different bills that have been introduced in 43 states. And in Georgia, Senate Bill 202 and was signed by Governor Kemp. This is a direct response to Black voters turning out in record numbers in the middle of a pandemic. It is a most egregious bill. It exposes the true nature of the Republican-controlled House and Senate and the General Assembly, as well as the governor trying to do, which is to disenfranchise the Black voters that came out in record numbers for last year's general election. And it is fueled by the big lie that was voter fraud that kept Donald Trump from winning the presidential race. There's no evidence of voter fraud. So this is a solution in search of a problem. It has dire consequences for our rights, from the absurd to the draconian. As an example, the absurd is that the law criminalizes giving people standing in line water and snacks. It also, on the other end of the spectrum, and one of the most draconian parts of the bill is that it gives the power of oversight for the state elections board to the state legislature to appoint the head of the elections board, which means the Republicans will control that position, and it stripped the Secretary of State of his authority with that board. From that point, it authorizes the election board to take over any county election board that it deems is not following appropriate mandates. So specifically, if this law had been in place in November of 2020, this board could have essentially stepped in and usurped the power of Fulton County Board of Elections and therefore disenfranchised the votes of hundreds of thousands of Fulton County voters. So this is a grave bill, and we're going to continue to fight it. Remember that in the general election, they found no voter fraud in any of those absentee ballots that were audited. So again, this is a solution in search of a problem. And the reality is the problem that the Republicans have is that they don't have the ideas that will garner the kind of support that will make them viable. So the only alternative is to diminish the votes from people that they believe will not vote for them.
This is Hari Akshababa at Radio Phoenix. Most of the voting rights bills introduced in the Arizona legislature this session were directed at suppressing early voting. A few of them did make it out of committee, but many were never even heard. Sandy Barr, director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club, tracks all these bills, and she generously zoomed in to share updates. And this report is a transcription from our conversation. One bill still in play, SB 1485, will probably come to the floor early this week. It'll purge voters from the permanent early voting list if they don't vote early. Most Arizonans now vote early. In fact, maybe as many as 80%. It's popular with voters all across the spectrum. Turnout started going up in 2018 and then again in 2020. With this bill, SB 1485, if the voters don't mail their votes in early in two consecutive election cycles, they'd be stricken. The permanent early voting list will no longer be permanent. Another bill still in consideration, SB 1713, will require an ID for early voting in addition to the affidavit signature. Ballots would be disqualified if there are mistakes in entering a driver's license number or a voter registration number or such. And the ballot envelope will have to be opened up for validating because the signature will have to be placed inside with the ballot instead of on the outside as before. So that'll strip away some privacy. SB 1106 has a bunch of provisions in it. One in particular is that it would make it a felony for someone to forward a ballot out of state. For example, a household member serving in the military or off at college or on mission. The legislature has for a long time been averse to voter initiatives. In Arizona, this is how we advance things like health care and minimum wage, education, and taxing wealth. The Republican majority are stealthily trying to amend the state constitution. With us since the statehood days, or the progressive era back in 1912. One crazy bill, SB 1531, mandates that a circulator would have to read out loud the text of a measure before you sign the petition. This stipulation, it's not for informing, rather, it's for disqualifying signatures. Luckily, amendments our legislators pass amongst themselves would still have to go to the voter. Another bill, SCR 1034, is designed to blow a hole in the Voter Protection Act. This was Prop 105. This was voter-initiated. That makes it difficult for the legislature to change ballot measures that the voters have approved. They need a 3/4 supermajority, and their changes have to further the purpose of the original measure. With SCR 1034, if the courts find a problem with any provision in a comprehensive measure, that would open up the whole bill for the legislature to do whatever they want with it. Repeal it, revise, or defund it altogether. Conventional thinking is that these Arizona bills are designed to benefit Republicans over Dems, but there are a couple Republicans balking at some of these bills. As Sandy said, it's better to change results of votes by appealing to people, not by trying to keep people from voting, which is what they would do. Many thanks to Sandy Barr, director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club, for sharing her insights into the Arizona legislature. This is Hariaksha Bubba for COVID, Race, and Democracy.
On Thursday, April 8th, the Texas State Senate passed a bill that could lead to new restrictions on early voting. If this and other bills are signed into law, Texas' larger cities, where voters have often faced lines during recent elections, would be impacted the most. Senate Bill 7 would limit extended early voting hours, ban drive-through voting locations that were created to make voting accessible to more people, and forbid local election officials from encouraging voters to submit vote-by-mail applications. Other bills being considered propose dozens of more types of restrictions, including imposing criminal penalties for mistakes made by election officials. At KPFT, Pacifica Community Radio in Houston, radio host Dr. Obidike Kamau spoke with Cecil Durant, a Houston attorney and political analyst, about the new laws and their roots in a systemic design of voter suppression.
The United States, and Texas in particular, is becoming browner and black. And the Republican Party, which has a 150-year history of suppressing vote, and they are hoping that by turning up the heat, that it will work for them in the future.
How has voting suppression evolved from the days of literacy tests and poll taxes to now?
Well, it's very important for us to understand our right to vote has always been in jeopardy. Even when I was a little child back in the 50s, people had to pay poll tax. My father, my grandfather, all my relatives always paid the poll tax. They paid it with a frown on their face. They realized that the reason it was there was to prevent us from voting. I remember my grandfather and all my elderly relatives saying, there must be a reason that they're making it as difficult as possible. I actually have a copy of the Louisiana literacy test. Now, mind you, I had relatives in Louisiana that had doctor's degrees. Zero black folks were able to pass it, but white people who couldn't read and write always were able to pass it. Some of these tests involve, explain to me the 13th Amendment of the Constitution to my satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Well, obvious. All a person has to do is look at it and say, nope. You didn't explain to my satisfaction, so you're not intelligent enough to vote. And we have to understand these weren't tests. How many bubbles in a bottle of soap? How many jelly beans are in this jar? Because there was no merit to them. There was no logic to it. These were obstacles that were set up
specifically to take away our right to vote. However, the courts ruled and struck down all these things. Well, let me just cut to the chase. Shelby County v. Holder, the Supreme Court, which was a 5-4 decision, the 5 Republicans against the 4 Democrats in 2013, ruled that all that stuff that the South was doing way back then, the states that were suppressing Black people's rights to vote, they don't do that anymore. Everything's fair. And so we're going to gut the Voting Rights Act. What did these states do as soon as they gutted it? Went right back to the same dirty tactics they were doing before the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965.
And as soon as the Voting Rights Bill was gutted in 2013, they began actively voter suppressing again.
No doubt about it. I can go to specific things that have occurred right here in our great state of Texas. Let's just go back 2010 before they gutted it. You didn't see people standing in line for 6 hours, 8 hours. You didn't see that, but you see it now. You don't see it occurring where people of Caucasian descent live. You see it in the African-American communities. In the state of Texas, there were 700 polling places closed, and they were primarily closed in Black and Hispanic communities. At one time, there was one polling place for every 4,000. Now there's one polling place for every 7 to 8. This is specifically designed, these long lines, this long waiting, is specifically designed for people to drive up and say, wait a minute, man, I'm not going to sit in no line in this hot sun or in this pouring rain for no 5 hours to vote. I'm going back home. It is an effective form of voter suppression. Texas closed 542 polling sites, and the majority of them were closed in the most populated Black and Latino counties. These areas where they've closed 542 polling sites, places, have gained 2.5 million people in population. The clerk says, this is a bunch of bull manure. Well, we're attempting to save money, and we're attempting to make voting more efficient. And we're tempting, I mean, I can go on and on with the bull malarkey that they've come as to their reasoning. We're not discriminating against Black people and Hispanic people. We want all votes to count. I'm the kind of person who will look them straight in the face and say, liar, liar, pants on fire.
Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
Welcome back to Pacifica Network's COVID Race and Democracy. I am one of your hosts, Ursula Rudenberg, here with Stephanie Schubert. Today, we are exploring the historic struggle for voter rights in America in light of a recent wave of state laws that would restrict voter access. Expressing concern about the integrity of the 2020 elections, leaders of Republican-led states across the U.S. are calling for over 350 new voter laws. The state of Iowa was an early adopter. 4 months after Iowans voted in record numbers, the Republican-majority legislature approved measures changing voting. Governor Kim Reynolds signed them into law on March 8th. Political reporters Laura Bellin and Dennis Hart at KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa, reviewed what has been changed.
County auditors are not allowed to mail absentee ballot requests to everyone in their jurisdictions. Late August will be the first time people will be able to request a ballot for the next general election.
There's also going to be less time for auditors to mail ballots.
They shortened the time for voting by mail in 3 ways. They took 9 days off the front end, then they took 5 days off the middle, then they also cut 6 days off the back end. Under previous law, if you mailed your ballot on time, on or before the day before the election, it could be counted if it arrived by the Monday after the election. Now there's a firm deadline. Ballots have to be in the auditor's office by 8 p.m. on election day, or you're out of luck. So if you mailed your ballot a week before the election and it takes 10 days to get there, your vote's not going to be counted.
And that may be one of the most critical aspects of this whole thing, because many voters get their ballots in the mail the day before in a lot of states, and they are counted in a lot of states, even if they arrive 3-4 days afterward.
Not in Iowa anymore. One thing that's going to be a problem for a lot of voters is if they mail you your ballot and it takes a few days to arrive and you make a mistake filling it out, currently you can call your county auditor and they can send you a new packet. At this point, you know, it's unlikely that there would be time and you won't be able to get a replacement ballot. For snowbirds who spend the winter in other states, or for people with a disability or people elderly who don't drive, that's going to be a real problem.
The bill also makes it more difficult to hand deliver completed ballots.
Yes. Right now, you can give your ballot to anybody to hand deliver to the county auditor. And under the new law, only the voter, somebody living in the voter's household, an immediate family member, or a caretaker is authorized to deliver a ballot. This is going to be just a big problem, especially for people with disabilities. There are lots of people now have a friend, a neighbor, someone they know from church, any trusted friend like that deliver their ballot. All of that is going to be illegal under the new law. And so if you live alone and you can't drive and you don't want to trust the mail because you're worried about it not arriving on time, it's going to be pretty hard for you to get your ballot in. They also took 9 days off the in-person voting that happens at the county auditor's office or in satellite voting locations. Expect longer lines for people voting early in person. The poll closing time for state and federal elections is now moved to 8 p.m. That's a problem for quite a few shift workers. Also, with this bill, it's easier to move voters to inactive status. Hundreds of thousands of Iowans who vote in presidential years, but not typically in midterms, are going to be unpleasantly surprised when they show up in 2024 and have trouble casting a ballot. They're going to find that they're not on the active registered voter list. So if you're inactive and then you show up to vote, you have to bring additional proof of identification and residence. And if they haven't brought with them some kind of proof of address that they live in the precinct, they might be turned away. So I do think that that's going to probably trip up some voters as well. Also, another part of the bill dramatically increases the number of signatures that third-party candidates need to collect in order to run for federal offices. And that's designed to make it burdensome for independent or third-party candidates. And then the other area is this bill creates a possibility to have more criminal penalties against county auditors. One of the Democratic legislators who's a law professor at the University of Iowa, Christina Bahanan, thinks that these provisions on county auditors' technical infractions are too vague and they might be unconstitutionally vague. They basically make the Secretary of State the judge and jury, and he can impose a fine on county auditors for technical infractions which aren't defined in the law.
We know, Laura, that Iowa is among really a national wave of Republican-led states whose leaders have expressed doubts about the integrity of the election. Democrats say this new law is going to suppress the vote count. Republicans say it's going to improve the integrity of the election. But there wasn't a lot of doubt about the integrity of the election. No evidence of widespread voter fraud, either in Iowa or across the nation.
There was no even allegation of fraudulent early voting, whether by mail or in person in Iowa. I mean, there just weren't any problems. A lot of people have been asking me, why would they restrict voting? Trump won the state by 8 points. Well, actually, the early voters did prefer Joe Biden. And in most of the races, the early voters did skew toward the Democratic candidate. So I think Republicans still see a competitive advantage if they can make it more difficult for people to vote early. So these discussions are ongoing. And one of the common threads is Republican legislatures trying to make it more difficult to vote early.
Do you need me closer? I can come closer with the wheelchair.
Yeah, that'd be great. Jan, please introduce yourself. Tell us what your disability is and what your daily life is like.
My name is Jan Driesman. I was born with cervical spina bifida, a birth defect that damages the spinal cord from neck on down. So I'm in a wheelchair pretty much all the time, and that has been for the last 2-3 years. I was not isolated like many people with the diagnosis are.
So you're somebody who is living with a significant disability, but you're living independently. You're not in a care facility of any sort.
Yes. I have a degree in education, and I've worked for the past 21, 22 years with the community school district. I'm very adamant about continuing to live independently with people who come into my home a couple times a day.
Have you voted since you were voting age?
Not every single time. It really depends on accessibility, the proximity of where to vote. The stress of it can be overwhelming if you're not in an area where you can get to the building, and then it depends on the weather. To stand there for that length of time in line in November makes it emotionally, mentally challenging. I'm pretty sure there were a lot of people who didn't vote that were qualified to vote. Some people have anxiety of being around a large group of people, and then to make a decision knowing that other people are waiting, that causes even more anxiety.
Would you say that it's important to a lot of disabled people to be able to vote by mail?
Yes. The freedom of having it home to decide, I think, makes a big difference in not feeling rushed and feeling confident. Except that if you have a person who is homebound and can't leave their home, and then on top of that, to know that mail-in voting probably won't get to where it needs to go officially, then that even blocks them even more. People will probably go, well, why am I even doing this? What was to be the purpose of it? I'm just one vote.
Say you were worried about the mail being reliable. Or say you missed, for some reason, the window of opportunity to mail in your ballot by the deadline. Would you have transportation to go to deliver your ballot?
No. And I'm in a wheelchair. Who has transportation accessible to the electric wheelchair?
Now, this new law that has just been passed in Iowa makes it illegal for you to give your ballot to somebody to bring to the county auditor's office unless that person is a family member or an official caretaker for you. Would you have any family members who
No.
would be able to deliver that?
No. I don't have family members here in town, and nobody's going to come to the different town to deliver my vote. Yeah.
Right. Do you have the kinds of caretakers that work for you that would be in a position to drive to the town next door where the auditor's office is to deliver the vote?
No. There's a listing of things that they can and can't do, and out-of-town transportation is not one of them. So it would have to be something that they would do on their own time and volunteer their time, and I would not feel comfortable asking them.
Do you want to vote in the next election?
I think it's very important to, yes.
Do you think that restrictions add to the unlikelihood that people will vote who are disabled?
You're eliminating a lot more people. And this is supposed to be a country of representing all people. When the colonial time wanted to break away from England, they set up the voting to deter having a king. They wanted the people to represent the country, except that they wanted to be the ones who decided who the people were to govern the country. So you had to be white men of 21 years of age that owned land. And this is a way of holding power. So if you have a way of controlling the voting, then you believe that you have a way of controlling the country. So if you can control who votes and how they vote, then you think you can control how the land is going to be operated. So instead of it being all encompassed, you make that pot smaller with the intent, I believe, of deciding who, again, is going to have a voice.
Is it important for disabled people to have a voice in government?
Oh, my God, yes. Yes. It gets to be sometimes the survival of the fittest in this country rather than survival of the community. Inclusive means everyone involved in the community, taking care of all of the community with respect to the individual.
Do you think that disabled people are being taken care of in Iowa?
No, no. I don't even know where to begin. There's just so much there. It's so rooted in our way of thinking that it's like blinders. It's like, oh, I have to take care of them. I don't need to be taken care of. I need assistance. If an insurance company can say to me, you'll never be cured, and we're not obligated to maintain, that says a lot to me. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, was asked to define civilization, and she defined it not by how their artifacts were discovered, but by recovered broken bones of the leg. Because if you have a broken leg, it meant that another person had to stay with you, provide for your healing, provide for your food, provide for your protection. She said that would be the first time that a population became a civilized, because it meant that people cared about the other. That's the definition of leaders. Leadership is there to provide for those they are in charge of. Inclusive means everyone involved in the community. So if my leaders of this land do not respect those that they are in charge of enough to provide support, why are they calling themselves leaders?
Thank you so much for going into it. I'm Ursula Rudenberg in Ames, Iowa, for COVID Race and Democracy. After speaking with Jan Driesman, I spoke by telephone from KHOI Community Radio with Joe Henry, political director of the Iowa Chapter 307 of LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, about how the new Iowa voting laws will affect Latino voters.
6% of the population here in Iowa is composed of the Latino community. Iowa has been a great place for opportunities to work in various capacities. That has been its history. Iowa was built by immigrants. LULAC is the oldest and largest national Latino civil rights organization in the U.S., and we work hard to represent our people. The voter suppression bill was passed in the Iowa legislature. In our view, this bill will suppress the vote. So we are going to fight it here in Iowa. We have attorneys who will represent us, and we're looking forward to our day in court to make it clear that this bill violates our right to vote in creating undue harm to our community and, of course, to many Iowans. Clearly, this bill has been orchestrated, as has others. This is part of the prior president's mantra that the election was stolen. So they are now shifting from fraud to voter security, which means to us restricting the right to vote. And we would also say that this is a form of racism. This is a modern-day Jim Crow bill. There are groups being funded heavily who do not want democracy. And clearly, this bill reflects that. We've seen this before, so this has been an ongoing thing that we've had to deal with.
Does LULAC have any sense of how the communication chain actually happens?
The Koch brothers were instrumental in providing templates, basically passing it from state to state. Clearly, Iowa was an opportune state. We know that the former Secretary of State from Kansas, Kurt Kobach, was kind of an author of these bills back in 2002, I believe. So there is this push to create templates for state legislatures to use, kind of fill in the blanks with this legislation. Just take this template and then push it in the state legislature and then have it signed off by the governor. So when we look at Iowa, we're kind of ground zero here. We're one of the first states to have this legislation passed. We feel that this is unconstitutional. It's very clear. When you limit the right to vote after 1.7 million people in Iowa voted last year, which is record-breaking not only on the number, but a million people who voted by mail ballot, that's a record. You know, that shows right there. To have this type of legislation that would then limit early voting and also reduce the amount of time to vote on Election Day is unconscionable. It smells of racism. The Secretary of State last year even baited for the record that this was a well-run election in Iowa. No fraud was brought up. So what is happening now, the legislators have said on the Republican side, is that they are attempting to secure the vote or to reassure voters that everything is correct. The only thing that's being reassured here is the smell of racism. 15% of Iowa voters are brown and black, and clearly this is a way to limit their right, because many of our people within our black brown and Asian communities, our young people, who voted for the first time, and to limit their opportunity to vote early and also to vote on Election Day, when the conservatives, the Republicans, know that many of our young people not only have limited transportation, but may have multiple jobs going to school. Our elders are in the same situation.
LULAC is saying that the new voter laws puts undue burden on LULAC to fulfill its mission. Is that correct?
This legislation would remove the opportunity to go door-to-door, to work with our community, to do early voting. It would prevent us from working with voters to help them with filling out their ballot and delivering it to county election offices. It would be committing a crime for anybody to carry back the ballot in the secret envelope to the county election offices. We've never had that before. We've had early voting for 40 plus years. We've had the right to work with community members to deliver those ballots. Let me also say, Iowa only allows the ballot and the instructions to the ballot to be printed in English. So here we are at the door, we're trying to translate for our community members who may not be English-speaking in a primary way. And the next time around, we won't be able to help them fill out their ballot, to help them making sure that it gets delivered back to the election office, because we know what happened last year with the post office, where ballots were not being delivered on time. In addition, to then reduce the amount of time on Election Day, if our people are working a couple jobs, they might be working morning through late afternoon into the evening, they would not be able to vote on Election Day. So we're kicked out in all different types of directions here. And clearly, in their eyes, methodically, they see this as catering to white, older, regular voters. So it is a ploy. We know it, and we feel that we can win this.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The further you take my rights away, the faster I will.
The United States of America goes around the world preaching democracy, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness. In practice, it has been a long struggle for people in this country. At the Philadelphia Convention in September of 1787, only white men with property were able to vote. Women did not win the formal right to vote until 1920, and it did not include women of color. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was passed. It granted African Americans the rights to citizenship. And in 1870, Congress passed the 15th Amendment, which says the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Yet states still found ways to circumvent the Constitution with poll taxes, literacy tests, fraud, and intimidation. Many states used the so-called grandfather clause to keep descendants of slaves out of elections. The clause said you could not vote unless your grandfather had voted. The Supreme Court struck it down in 1915. In 1964, the 24th Amendment prohibited the use of poll taxes. In a major win for the civil rights movement, the 1965 Voting Rights Act prohibited the states from using literacy tests and other methods of excluding African Americans from voting. Attempts to disenfranchise minorities in the United States continue to this day. We'll now hear voices of leaders, compliments of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper who had been picking cotton since she was six, was among the original members of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and in a national broadcast, she testified before the convention's credentials committee. She passionately told her own story, including the brutal beating she'd received for her registration efforts. At the end of her speech, she questioned her country's professed ideals.
Is this America? The land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to seek
with our telephones off of the hook, because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America. Thank you.
Cesar Chavez at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, a 1992 talk, recorded by Radio Free Maine.
I went to register Chicanos to vote in California back in 1948, before people knew there was voting. And we had all the fights with the county registrar boards who didn't want us to register to vote. I went through all that, being called a communist because I wanted people to vote. And I went and we did the biggest registration drives in Americanization imagined. And so we voted and we won by a majority vote. And we worked like heck to get the majority to vote for this individual, to get him elected, to send him to Washington, to the state legislature.
We thank Mark Torres of the Pacifica Radio Archives for sharing these recordings. As early as 1857, the African-American thinker Frederick Douglass warned us that if there is no struggle, there is no progress. For Pacifica, I'm Polina Vasiliev.
My husband and I are going to vote together this afternoon, so even if we have to wait for 2 hours, we're going to wait it out, because that's the least we could do for our ancestors. Things like that have history with my family from being sharecroppers in North Carolina. So, you know, I know about having to go to the back door of a white man's house. And I remember when my grandmother first wanted to vote in 1968, they made her recite the Constitution in North Carolina just to get a voter's registration card. So for that, I always vote, no matter what.
Must remain helpful.
Ursula Rudenberg speaking with Robert Hoffman of the ACLU.
We have numerous states who saw what happened during the 2020 election, understand that there were lessons to be learned, and are seeking to make it more accessible for voters in the future. So you can look at states which immediately following the 2020 election passed laws that increased access. Kentucky just created 3 days of early voting to increase access for Kentuckians in future elections. New Jersey signed legislation recently that will create 10 days of early voting for general elections. Virginia passed the Virginia Voting Rights Act, which is modeled after the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to provide additional protections for voters. In Delaware, they are currently debating a possible constitutional amendment to remove the need to provide an excuse in order to cast an absentee ballot. And then in Nevada and Vermont, they're considering legislation that will allow the government to send out ballots by mail to all registered voters as part of conducting an election. Looking at overall legislation, there are more pieces of legislation that are looking to expand access to the ballot. There are, I believe, over 700 bills throughout the country that are seeking to expand access. However, I think the bills that are gaining the most traction are those bills that are looking to restrict access to the ballot. If individuals are looking for a way to impact voting legislation in this country, they should contact their member of Congress and advocate for them to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and support enactment of the Voter Empowerment Act. The federal government does have the ability to pass legislation to put requirements on states when they are conducting federal elections. On the voter modernization front, there is legislation recently reintroduced in the Senate and the House, I believe earlier this week, called the Voter Empowerment Act. It's a piece of legislation that was originally authored by Congressman John Lewis, a voting rights hero. What that legislation will do is create the opportunity for all citizens in America to take advantage of online voter registration, use automatic voter registration when interacting with DMVs and other state agencies. It will restore the right to vote for individuals upon release from incarceration. So it's going to do a lot of great things on the voter modernization front. And then we're also going to be advocating for the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that will be reintroduced in the coming months here in Congress, that will provide additional protections for voters throughout the country after the Supreme Court unfortunately gutted portions of the Voting Rights Act in 2013.
Do you feel that the country is going to end up in the next election with more people able to vote or less people able to vote?
I think we're at a crossroads in the discussion over voting rights in America.
This is an all-out war.
Author and activist Harvey Wasserman.
So what we showed in 2020, which was in fact the best run election, the fairest election in American history, we showed that a grassroots turnout will turn the tide in an American election. I've been dealing with election theft issues since 2004. There's all sorts of manipulations that have gone on at the grassroots and in many other levels to make sure that Black and brown people are deprived of their right to vote, as with students, young people. In 2016, by the way, millennials, at that time it was people under 30, voted more than 60% against Trump, and it happened even more in the 2020 election because those Generation Z, the Zoomers, are coming online. So the younger people in this country are overwhelmingly opposed to the Trump cult and the Republican Party. And part of the reason is that the millennials and the Zoomers are much more diverse than any generation we've had in history. And so the Republicans are desperate to prevent these people from voting. And unfortunately, because of manipulation that happened in 2010 and gerrymandering, the Republicans have supermajorities in the state legislatures in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, Arizona. This is not reflective of the will of the public, quite the opposite. We have a minority government in this country, the minority being the white males, so-called Christians, that dominate the Trump cult. And they are using their powers in the gerrymandered state legislatures to put in these laws to prevent young people and people of color from voting. This is the core struggle for the control of America right now. Between now and 2024, we are going to decide if we can have fair elections in this country and who's really going to control this country. I run a Zoom call every Monday with Joel Siegel at 5 p.m. Eastern time. On this, we go about an hour and a half. This will be our 46th coming up. If anybody wants to join in our Zoom calls on election protection, it's the Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition. You can email me directly at solartopia@gmail.com. That's solartopia@gmail.com. Email me if you want to join our Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition calls.
Your organization, Grassroots Emergency Election Protection, is nonpartisan, right?
We are bipartisan in our opposition to stolen elections.
That was election protection activist Harvey Wasserman. His organization's website is Grassroots Emergency Election Protection at grassrootsep.org. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
We are going to fight here in Iowa.
The political director of Iowa Chapter 307 of LULAC, Joe Henry.
And we're looking forward to our day in court to make it clear that this bill violates our right to vote in creating undue harm to our community and, of course, to many Iowans. This is not who we are. Historically, things have been pretty fair and impartial. As a state, we were the ones who put it in our Constitution, the very beginning, the right to vote. We also put into our Constitution, after the state was formed years later, about ending discrimination, ending racism. When you limit participation, the Constitution of Iowa is being violated. And here we are, falling prey to a playbook of conservatives who want to exclude people of color and others from voting because they just want to win. But they're going to win at the cost of removing democracy. And yes, at the end, it's going to impact white voters too, especially young white voters. It will impact everybody. And that's, again, another reason why we need to fight this. And we feel that we can win this in court. We have a track record here, too. We took on voter suppression in 2012. We took on the voter ID bill, which was put forth in 2017. So we feel that we can win this in court.
We have to understand that in 2016, we were 48th out of the 50 states when it came to voting.
In Houston, Texas, attorney and political analyst Cecil Durant.
In 2020, we were number 42, which shows that we have to keep the same resolve that we had in 2020. These bills will come up and the governor will definitely sign it. What we have to do is what's being done in Georgia right now. We have to have an economic impact. If you can recall, I'm going to use something that people can relate to. When Martin Luther King boycotted in Montgomery, Alabama, they didn't ride the buses for a year and 2 months. Not only that, but they boycotted a great number of businesses. The people that we do business with economically, we are not going to continue to support a situation that harms us and that alienates us from our rights. The corporations are starting to address it right now. We have to have an economic impact.
At least 3 different suits have been filed with a number of individuals and civic engagement and civil rights groups, and we expect more to come.
Chairman of Political Action at the NAACP Atlanta, Ray McClendon.
So that's the first front in federal court through legal remedies. So that's one front. The second is that several groups now are calling on major corporations in Georgia to take action to condemn the law and to take direct action from their respective corporate positions as members of the Chamber of Commerce and members of the communities in which they are headquartered to push against these bills in a couple of different ways. One, we want them to speak out. And 2, we want them to also stop funding the political action committees and election committees of anyone who was voted for or were sponsors of this bill. We are engaged with these corporations right now. And if we don't see the kind of progress we would like to see, then there'll be more actions with these corporations, including potential boycotts. So that's the second front. The third front then is that we are going to be relentless. We're going to continue to register voters. And more importantly, we're going to educate voters on what their rights are as citizen voters and what the new requirements will be until we can get this law overturned, how they can still protect their right to vote and make sure that their voices are heard. What we recognize is that democracy is something that you have to work at to sustain it. And this is a test of democracy. This is bigger than one set of voting bills. It's not about drop boxes. It's not about mail-in ballots. This is an existential threat to democracy where you have a minority in fear of losing power that is determined to embrace authoritarianism in order to sustain its power. We must call it what it is, and therefore every person, every human person, every corporate person has got to take a stand on where you are. Are you pro-democracy or are you pro-authoritarianism and minority rule? And so we're calling people out on that. Because the very future of what this country will look like for your children and grandchildren depend on what happens over the next 2 to 4 years. And we're challenging citizens to stand up. You can email NAACPAtlanta.org, or you can send us an email and we'll reach out to see where your interests lie and how you can help us, so that we can continue to register people to vote. We have thousands of people that are turning 18 every day, thousands of people who are moving to Georgia, not registered to vote or need to re-register, who have moved since the last election. And as we prepare for municipal elections later this year, we need to begin to galvanize now for that, which will be our first exposure to these new laws and allow us almost a trial run on what we will need to be faced with in 2022 for the state races and, of course, the governor's race next year. So it's all of our fight. This is an all hands on deck time in our history.
That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced and edited by me, Stephanie Schubert, and Ursula Rudenberg. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. Special thanks to Ann Garrison. Thanks also to Heather Gray of WRFG in Atlanta and Hariak Shababa of Radio Phoenix in Phoenix, Arizona, and Mark Torres from the Pacifica Archives.